Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Red Box, the politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. And a special hello to Silas2511 and D. Lockwood, who said nice things about us on iTunes, and to Sunshine D, who said less nice things about us being increasingly sanctimonious and smug, as if I care. On this week's episode, we've got politics, penguins and pills. Times columnist Alice Thompson wonders if we really should get involved in trouble. Matthew Paris asks, do we get the bang for our buck on mental health? But first, after all the excitement of last week, the coup against Theresa May is off for now. Times political editor Francis Elliott asks how the plotters got it so wrong.
The Brexiteers' sputtering coup shames a party that used to do disloyalty so well. What's worse is that many leading leavers were key figures in the defenestration of Ian Duncan Smith 15 years ago. They really ought to know how to do it, now they're there on the other side.
We were always told the Tories, they were ruthless. They knew how to get rid of it. When things were bad, they would get rid of a leader, and it turns out they're rubbish.
Train killers, everyone.
What's gone wrong?
They are hopelessly divided over tactics, over the succession, and over their end destination for Brexit. And in any case, this has been a sort of a crisis brewing over the last 2 years within their own ranks. Obviously, well, there was an external enemy of Theresa May. It was slightly disguised, but when they actually had to do something, which is act in a coordinated fashion, you know, we can see that they are unable to coordinate. The essential division is between those who think that now is the time and those who realise that if they trigger a vote, she's likely to win a vote of no confidence and therefore I would be safe from another vote of confidence for 12 months.
To what extent do you think that in the past, when they've got rid of Ian Duncan Smith, and actually even when they did the same to Margaret Thatcher, the stakes were less high at that precise moment in the fortunes of the party and the country? Are there some that are nervous about huffing a prime minister out at this precise moment?
Well, obviously that is part of the background. I mean, the defenestration of Ian Duncan Smith was well between two elections. It was safe to do so. There was a sort of agreed procedure in that sort of inimitable way that Tory parliamentary politics particularly can evolve, that actually there needn't to be, you know, that there was a successor in Michael Howard. If you remember, it rippled out from a disastrous party conference.
Turning up the volume.
Within 2 weeks, all standing up as a sort of, you know.
The endless standing ovations.
Think everyone felt sorry for Theresa May, which no one was, we weren't planning on that really. I mean, it sounds terrible, but we didn't think that you were going to get this huge groundswell of sympathy for her just for being there and standing up. And there was a moment when she was talking about the fact that she'd gone back to her constituency one night and done the washing, and that's the kind of detail people absolutely love. They love the idea that this woman just kept going when everyone else was completely flaky, when they were all thinking about themselves, even though she probably was thinking about herself. There's a sense that she was thinking about the country when no one else was, and I think that's what's happened, is that the MPs quite often go back to their constituencies over a weekend, and I think a lot of their constituents will have said, this poor woman, what are you doing to her?
I'm quite sure you're right. I spend more than half my life outside London in the Midlands, and there is something approaching a wave of sympathy for Theresa May, particularly amongst Tory grassroots and particularly amongst women Tory grassroots. They are leavers, most of them, but they're not particularly ideological about it, and they see a woman under siege from what they see as a lot of silly boys.
Do the grassroots always cling to their leader longer than MPs?
Yes.
It might be a completely useless leader, but they're our completely useless leader, and we should be loyal.
They're loyal,
doing a difficult job.
They have the quality of loyalty, which
which has been lacking the rest of us
in the last few days.
No, they're also not ambitious either, are they?
No.
I mean, they're
no,
not ambitious for themselves. They're ambitious for their party and they want to be on the right side. They're not ambitious for their future because most of them aren't going to be doing much more than maybe being a councillor.
And I detect a sort of, we've passed a point where that's not my Brexit amongst ordinary people who just literally just want this done. They want it finished. Yeah. They want to talk about something else.
Something called Brexit. Anything.
Yeah. If it, you know.
And that's the thing. If Theresa May can spend the next couple of weeks just saying, this is a deal. This is the deal. Let's just vote it and we can get on to our bright new future.
Absolutely.
Then that's it as a big...
I thought there was a very interesting moment where, you know, she decided to speak directly to constituency chairman. Could have been pretty fatal. I mean, if, I think there's been a paradigm shift amongst leavers, pragmatic leavers, who want it done, want it finished, want to go out and know in their souls that, the country is not doing itself any favours in obsessing about this tiny details of the Northern Ireland backstop.
Technical question here, Francis. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether it might be technically true that the chairman of the 22 committee has 48 letters or more, but those who have written the letters have said, but hold on to this letter and don't use it until I say so. And I wonder whether the problem is to get all those people who have sent in letters to say that now is the moment to detonate them.
It is opaque as to whether or not you can have a sort of preloaded sort of IED letter that you can...
Yes.
You know. There is a verification process, I think, when he reaches that. But I don't think that is allowing anybody else to see the letters. I do think that he would spend some time ringing around saying, are you sure?
Mm.
You know, is this still live? Is this still your view? But Michael Spicer, his chairman, had 19 forgeries amongst his...
So he was... You interviewed him for the Times this week. He was the chairman of the 1922...
Who preceded...
Who came before and was there when
did the numbers and actually has the experience of being... So we know, we have a historical precedent for what happens when the total is reached. At that time, I think it was about 28 because that's our metric was so small. You know, and then one canard is that Theresa May would have a 24-hour notice period and, you know, that's not true. Brady would go to Seema Kennedy, Theresa May's PPS, within couple of hours and say we're there. In that couple of hours I think he would be spending a ringing round, you know, and there may be some letters in the pile that, you know, to be used. Please check in with me, Graham, before you know, count this. I think it's more likely that lots of people have been telling big fat porkies.
Seems so unlikely. Yes. That politicians would do that. And there was a great story in your interview with Michael Spicer about the extreme lengths that people will go to to cover up that they were submitting one of these letters.
Yes, including somebody wearing a false moustache.
What was that?
meeting his secretary in Westminster's tube station, I think, smuggled his letter of the magazine, and then the secretary who did actually, weirdly, she was the only person who also knew that there were sufficient letters, but anyway, came back full of giggles, he said.
But also it just adds to the idea.
But we still don't know. What's
it?
Amazing is that the confidentiality at that time, you know, even 15 years in his memoirs, he uses sort of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, and then he has to sort of find some more
disciples,
other less kind of biblical monikers for others. But you know, the fashion in those days was to do it confidentially rather than to wave it around at the 6 o'clock news.
But it does sort of add to the idea that it's such an extraordinary situation when you have letters going in and out and sort of almost the idea of postmen sort of delivering these. And you think, that's what the public can't really cope with. They're going, oh my God, this is a really serious situation and you're messing around.
It's a bit Hogwarts,
with how many letters, when you put the stamps on, whether or
well,
not...
There have been lots of Twitter memes of exactly that, sort of
in.
Loads of papers coming down the chimney.
The sort of magic ink. It's a kind of ridiculous sense that this is completely insane. What's going on? Then you've got this woman at the middle of it who actually isn't particularly efficient or isn't particularly good, but she just kind of keeps going on. And in the end, she's the one that you have to admire.
And what's this done for the reputations of those involved? Because I suppose in the Ian Duncan Smith thing was slightly different. Michael Howard wasn't the one orchestrating certainly not publicly, urging people to do it. But for you, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Steve Baker, possibly even Boris Johnson involved as well, what's it done for them and their reputation? Not just that they are disloyal, but also
incompetent.
Yeah.
Incompetently disloyal. It's not a great combination. let's see where we are. I mean, you know...
I mean, by the time this goes out, it could have triggered 48. Right, Charles, we'll cut all this out. It'll be fine.
It is the idea that they like being celebrities. That's, I mean, the most damaging for Jacob Rees-Mogg is that he always pretended and protested too much that he was really just doing this for the nation, that he was sort of upright. And I mean, I've always found him very irritating because I just think that he is so fake in so many ways, and there's that sense that he's sort of the upper middle class man who never changes a nappy, and he's always gone with that persona. And I always feel rather sorry for the wife struggling with the 6 children behind.
I think you don't need to. She's a very forceful character, apparently.
What, haven't you got a line, Matthew? Your column is not even properly posh.
Yes, you know, no, he isn't. I mean, they're just rich people from Somerset. They're not really posh, they're certainly rich.
Well, and journalists
he hyphenates
exactly.
Rees-Mogg, whereas really posh people don't hyphenate.
Anyway, I thought it was telling that even at the meeting, the ERG meeting, before he came out and did his little press conference, Tory MPs were telling him, you know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to join you in this mission. But he went out anyway because the cameras were waiting and he had to go and do something.
Moths to the flame.
Well, it'd be fascinating. And yeah, it's almost certainly going to all be proved wrong. But we thought it was all going to happen last Thursday when we did the podcast last week. It didn't happen. But it's now Tuesday. Who knows where we'll be by the end of this week? I'm sure at some point we'll come back to talking about Brexit. But let's move on and talk about something completely different, because there are other things going on in the world. This is Alice Thompson.
It's irrelevant whether a camera crew rescues baby emperor penguins from a chilly death or not, but it is vital to know whether, as the public, we should get involved in fights and terrorist attacks. The Met Police Federation has now said we need to get stuck in after the appalling incident in Wimbledon this weekend when a female officer was attacked. But the public can't become vigilantes. When the acting head of the Met didn't even help his own officer being stabbed to death in the Palace of Westminster, we can't expect the public to take these kind of risks.
There's quite a lot in there, Alice. I get the feeling we could talk for an hour about whether or not you should intervene to help the penguins. That is a slightly different... This is this BBC documentary where the crew ended up digging out the penguins who were trapped.
Do you want a moment on penguins?
Go on then. Where do you stand on penguins?
So my view is that all the men like Dynasties, which is the new David Attenborough programme, because the men are the sweet, kind, nice ones who look after the baby penguins and coddle them, do everything they can for them, whilst the women, once they've given birth, swim off for 4 months and eat. And then when they get stuck in a ravine, they also climb out of the ravine and leave their babies. So every man I know absolutely loves this series because it confirms everything they want to say, which is that they are better at looking after children than women are.
And what about film crews intervening?
And I think the film crew probably had to intervene. You couldn't not intervene when you were right beside them. And actually, they did let a few die, didn't they, before they got tragically upset.
Just get the footage.
They were quite clever in not actually touching them, but giving them those little steps up and then working out what was going to happen. But to be honest, this is going to happen. There's, you know, they do this migration every year. Every single year you're going to get babies falling into ravines, and we can't have a film crew there every single year. Whereas what is more important is the fact that we've had this incident that it was filmed of this female police officer being thrown in front of a bus by a sort of man karate chopping her pretty effectively. The sense then that the police saying the public need to get more involved, they can't just drive by. Actually, of course the public can't all stop their cars and get out and join a fight. You know,
and also, I thought
that
we were told not
that.
to the sort of have a go here at the number of awful stories of people who go out because there's some trouble on their doorstep.
Yeah.
Well, we had one in the Times this week, which was about the builder who went out and someone was ramming a jewellery shop, and he went out to try and stop them, and actually did stop them in the end, but he also got attacked very violently by one of them with a samurai sword.
These reports in papers don't really square with my own experience. One is always reading newspapers about someone being beaten up or abused while everybody just stood around and no one did anything. Every time I've ever been a witness to anything like this happening, the public does actually intervene. I wonder whether it's sometimes that it often takes people a minute or so to work out what's going on, by which time it's all over.
Francis?
Well, the London Bridge attacks obviously were full of amazing heroism. I mean, you know, Tobias Elwood at the Westminster Palace attack again, and he came out and said, you know, I just did what everyone should do, and people should do this more. I mean, I think the nature of this is that it's a split second decision. You know, I'd like to think I would get involved in the right way, but while being kind of aware of the risk, I don't think I would think about what Cressida Dick had told me whether to or not to in that moment. But I agree, you know, we are conflicted about it. The classic one is people kicking off on a bus, you know, when you're seeing someone just low level, kind of yet loutish, yobby behaviour on a bus. You know, I have had a word and, you know, feared for my, you know, and you know, had a fairly unpleasant time, and I haven't as well. So I think it's, I don't know, it's all really difficult.
It is difficult.
If you're protecting your kids, it's obviously very different.
Yeah.
You're protecting penguins. I'm also totally with the penguin thing. I remember seeing March of the Penguins. You remember that film?
Exactly.
I remember my son at the bus stop, nestling between my legs, being a baby penguin. And he came to me, Alice, me, not his mother. I'm not sure you would have built the ravine out of the... I think you'd have let them die.
Just let them die. Mm.
Yes.
I think we might have, actually.
Pull yourselves together.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
Where's your Brexit spirit? Get out yourselves.
We'd have been rather cross with the one woman who did get her baby out. I think that was definitely... not showing female solidarity.
Now, back to police. This is the weirdest topic of discussion that we've ever had. Do you think, because there's been a massive discussion about violent crime in London and the rate of stabbings, and you know, and then that becomes quite a debate about police funding and numbers. And is this call for us to get involved landed badly? Because it seems a bit like, well, there aren't enough coppers around. Exactly. So, you know, it's everyone for themselves, sort yourselves out. We can't come to your rescue all the time.
Well, that's what it is. But it's not just going to be a police numbers thing. I mean, there is a sense that there isn't a police presence on the streets, but they're also being asked to do such extraordinary things, the police now. So it's sort of all the hate crimes, you know, policing Twitter, policing online. There's sort of an extraordinary array of things they have to do. A lot of historic sex abuse, that sort of thing. They're just completely overloaded now. And I think that is very difficult for them. And then they've got an increase in these county lines, drug rings.
Well, if they're completely overloaded, what about Ted Heath and the Wiltshire police and all that? And every time anything goes wrong in policing, we get the same response from the police, which is they don't have enough money. They want more money and they want more officers. It may be true, but when it's the response to almost everything that goes wrong, you begin to wonder.
And you wrote a couple of weeks ago a pretty excoriating column about the police.
Yes, they're no good.
You think they're pretty hopeless. Mm.
You called them institutionally stupid.
Yes, yes.
What was the reaction you got?
I got some very stiff letters.
And several speeding tickets, by coincidence.
I checked that my MOT was in order, and it is.
Just explain what was the point, because you touched on it partly there with the Ted Heath case.
I was just saying that there are too many cases of crass incompetence by the police, and then, and this was the instructive thing, the officers concerned, or in some cases the chief constables concerned, simply being moved on to other better or equally good jobs. It strikes me that there is a culture within the police force of too much forgiveness, too much understanding. And I think the whole thing needs shaking up. I don't think we need all the county constabularies that we do. I think we should have a single national police force with a unified structure.
Police commissioners have failed, haven't they?
Oh, yes.
I mean,
what a waste of time.
Do you know who yours is? I think it's some
Labour deadbeat, I imagine, and, you know, to be replaced by a Tory deadbeat.
Although I think Cressida Dick would make quite a good cabinet minister. So she's quite good. The people at the very top, there are one or two exceptional examples of leadership when you do think, actually,
yes,
she'd be good anywhere, doesn't she? But maybe she bucks the trend.
They're too easily captured, the PCCs, I think, captured by the force. And I can see how you would be. You're asked in for a cup of tea with the chief constable. He takes you out with his officers on a particularly bad night in Chesterfield or wherever.
Told some intelligence about that chap, Paris.
Yeah. Photo of him up in every police station. Yeah. So where does it all end up politically? Does Sajid Javid have to respond to the idea of us getting involved, do you think, Alice?
Well, I think that might then escalate the whole thing. Hopefully everyone will slightly ignore the fact that they should be getting involved, because I think that is almost mob rule then. I think it is quite difficult to say. And also, do you then start having cut-offs? You should get involved when you get to 18, or you should get involved is it like national service? When you have sort of between 18 and 45 you can, but then after that there's a cut-off point because you might have a heart attack. It's impossible to tell. I think Matthew's probably right, but the main thing I think is that you need to look before you get involved, if you are going to get involved, because we haven't got the training, you're never quite sure what's going on, are you, in that first minute or two?
Quite often someone just has to take a chance and go in and have a go, and the people always will, as you say, despite official advice. Probably the official advice should be that you should be cautious and, generally speaking, steer clear. And we all know that official advice is there to be ignored.
Can we just have Matthew's story about how he saved a dog, though? Before
no. No, not that story again.
I don't know, you've not done it on the podcast before.
I jumped into the River Thames in 1978, in the middle of the winter, to rescue a drowning dog. And as Mrs. Thatcher told me afterwards, it was a very stupid thing to do. But I did rescue the dog.
Yeah. So you'd probably rescued the penguins as well, unlike Heartless Alice. In a sec, we're going to move on to mental health. We'll be back after this short break.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stephens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. I'm joined in the studio by Francis Elliott, Alice Thompson, and this is Matthew Paris.
There are new demands from business leaders for the government to enact manifesto promises on mental health in the workplace. There are lots of calls for spending on mental health. The Chancellor said, I think that, is it 10% of the budget of the NHS is going to go on mental health? And that's all marvellous. But my question is, how much bang for the buck do we actually get with mental health services? Is psychiatry a science? What is the systematic basis for psychiatrists? Where's the systematic evidence that they bring results, such as the evidence we have for the benefits of medicine? We know if you take certain pills, you get better. If you have certain bits of you cut out, you get better. I'm sure counselling and antidepressants help a bit, but how much? We should know this before we commit billions. I am not saying that mental health is not a huge scourge and a huge cost to the nation, but I'm asking whether we yet have a sufficiently developed, systematised, scientific approach to dealing with mental health to commit billions of public money to it.
Do you think part of the reason we don't know is because it hasn't had enough money spent on research and that sort of thing? And so as a result, sort of tried to play catch-up, money's just thrown at a problem?
No, I think it goes right back to the roots. We don't actually have a theory of the human mind. We have Jung, we have Freud, we have Adler. We have all kinds of theories as to how the human mind works and how it might be cured. But we're still in the dark ages when it comes to understanding how people are helped. We know people are sometimes helped. We know people are mostly helped by those who close to them, who love them and who know them. We know that counselling sometimes works, but what kind of study has been done with counselling? Why don't you take 100 people who've suffered trauma and give counselling to 50 of them and no counselling to the other 50 and see what difference it makes? I don't know. Has it been done?
What worried me, exactly what Matthew's saying, what really worried me is when the new money went in, he's right, we didn't actually know how it was being focused. So Theresa May says there was going to be money for, particularly for child mental health. Well, give all this different help to schools, and each school was going to have a counsellor. I think where Matthew's right is we have no idea whether these counsellors, who are all going to have to be trained up, how good that counselling is and whether it is going to have an effect, and actually whether it could have a detrimental effect if the counselling's not good enough. My guess is that if you're going to have counselling and help, it needs to be very good. And if it's bad, it probably is worse than ineffective.
And there's probably a few children in each school who really need help. But if you've got a counsellor in every school, there's a danger it just becomes a sort of their time gets caught up with school life and all that sort of thing. And you're right, if you have one in every school, that's a lot more people, so there's less money to go around, so there might be less good.
And universities have the same problem. They're now these huge, vast expansions that they've had. They then get these counsellors who are coming in, but actually what I think what Matthew's right is they need more human contact, a lot of these children, that they actually need more contact with adults who care about them, who are working with them, who can see what's happening and can flag things up, rather than just the ability to go and sign themselves in with a counsellor they've never met before, who might not know what the issues are or the problems are going to be surrounding them.
I've had two encounters with the police in the last 20 or 30 years. The first case, I saw a body by the banks of the River Thames, and I called the police and the whole thing was dealt with. I then had a number of calls from the police asking if I needed counselling because I'd seen a body. Most recently, just about 4 or 5 months ago, while I was actually asleep in a railway carriage, some kids got my bag and started distributing the contents of the wheelie case all over the carriage. I woke up, realised this, got everything together, got the bag back again, reported it to the police at Derby Station. I was asked whether I needed any sort of counselling after this. I really don't.
Maybe other people did after they saw your drawers being brandished around in a carriage. Francis, it is one of the things we've seen in politics in relatively recent years. Mental health has gone from something that basically nobody talked about to a sort of arms race of, well, if you're going to put in 10 billion, we'll put in 12 billion. You're not, you know, this.
Yeah, and it gets lost in the numbers. I mean, I don't know the truth of your question, whether or not there is a sort of strong evidence base for CBT or any of these things. I mean, I remember Patricia Hewitt actually kind of bringing this, you know, in 2008, and she was very hot on that. And there was even sort of talk of some sort of AI-delivered CBT, which does sound absolutely ghastly. But
what's CBT again?
Cognitive behaviour therapy. Yes, yes. You know, I mean, I would be guessing, but I would be surprised if there isn't any evidence base for it. I acknowledge that there probably ought to be better, and that there are limits to that, and that's just the nature of mental health. But it, as a catch-all, it doesn't really help us very much, does it? I mean, I think it's our own understanding. I mean, we don't just talk about health like that, do we, in that broad sense. We're not very good at, you know, teasing out where is depression, where is personality disorder. And you can see, you know, why politics has kind of gravitated towards the vague about it. These are difficult, you know, rather inflammatory subjects in some ways.
They are. They're very inflammatory. And the problem with the case I'm trying to make is it too easily begins to morph into grumpy old man just saying that there is no such thing as depression and we should all just pull our socks up and snap out of it. I have plenty of personal reason to know that depression is a huge scourge. It's very real. It's an enormous financial cost and it's terrific emotional cost. I only wonder whether we know how to treat it.
If you look at the women, the sort of age groups, they do spend far too much time, I think, on older people who are depressed and far too little. Well, not too much, but it's all weighted against people when they're older, when they're not getting involved, when children are younger. But the way they deal with it is by just chucking out these counsellors to every school. Actually, what they need to do is target it. So CAMHS is very underfunded. But it's not a sense of every school needs to look at every single child.
Otherwise, yes, service,
You'll never understand really what's going on if you just try and catch every child. Actually, what you need to be doing is targeting at one particular child in a school or a few particular children in a school that are having real problems.
Matthew, do you think that what you were just saying then, that part of the issue is that anyone who dares to question, is this the right thing to be doing? It's become a sort of, it's not identity politics, but being on the right side of mental health is a thing at the moment.
Yes.
In a way that people might question, well, is that the right health, you know, beta blockers, the right thing or whatever. But if you're questioning mental health strategies, you're seen to be not appreciating that it's a problem.
There's a whole range of issues of which fall into exactly the category you describe. The whole Add Me Too thing, the whole trans thing. These are all areas where one may actually have an entirely sensible, grown-up, sensitive, intelligent understanding of what's happening, but simply want to ask some questions. But the very asking of the questions seems to dub you as some kind of a sceptic who doesn't think there's a problem in the first place. It's really annoying, and it terrifically inhibits useful, sensible debate.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah. You're just judged not to be sound on that issue, so you shouldn't be listened to. And given that, I mean, this sort of falls on Matt Hancock because it's health spending, but then, you know, it's also schools or it's prisons or whatever. Is it something that the government is taking seriously enough. I mean, they talk a lot about it. Theresa May keeps talking
endlessly about it.
But it seems like years ago that Theresa May launched her mental health strategy.
This was going to be her big thing. Yeah. We'll catch up, I think, in time. I mean, you know, it just takes some time for people to learn the terms and identify what the kind of landscape is.
But it's also looking at a broad range of what you want, so that the GPs need to be able to say, you know, have you thought about exercise, have you thought about diet? It's looking at it all in the round and having the time with people to sort out what they need and what they don't need. There isn't a magic pill. That's the problem. That's the difficult. I think the difference between physical and mental ailments quite often is that actually it takes longer and it's harder to work out and it's often not as effective. A lot of antidepressants don't work. And I think for children in particular, you have to be really, really careful exactly what you're doing. And you do need really, really good staff and really good help.
And the answer isn't to sort of write into law that every child must have 5 minutes with a counsellor every academic year. That won't solve any problems.
It might actually make it worse, yeah, yeah. To be honest. Yeah. I think actually what, you know, you need help when you need it. It's like, you know, telling the world that they all need endless checkups to see whether or not, you know, they've got, you know, check for breast cancer, check. If you keep checking up, you then become worried, well, and that actually, then you're probably more likely to get ill. And I think it's the same with mental health. If you're constantly bombarding people with it, what you need to do is take the people who really do have a problem, who are really not being looked after at the moment, and try and help them.
And we use the term mental health. I'm not really sure what the boundaries of that definition are. If a doctor prescribes Ritalin to a troublesome child, does that come under the $10 billion that we're spending on mental health, or I don't know.
Well, I'll be surprised if anybody does. we shall see. It's an interesting topic, and one, you know, if God forbid we didn't have Brexit to fill our lives with joy, it's a subject we'd probably be talking about more often and possibly even better understand. That's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Francis, Matthew and Alice. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or wherever else it is that you get them from, where you can leave reviews on iTunes as well. We might read some out next week. Subscribe to my morning email. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.